The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So in this country, we are just a few days from what feels like the most contentious presidential election in my lifetime. And so, you know, the emotions, the feelings that are present for a lot of people, there's some anxiety, there's a lot of feeling of divisiveness. I think that's a big piece that I'm feeling, is so much divisiveness in the country and a lot of conflict and a lot of sense of hopelessness about that conflict. I have that, hear that from some people, the sense of how hopeless it feels. And so I just thought I would reflect a little bit on what the Buddha has to say about conflict, and maybe some of the teachings that might be supportive for us at this time. You know, the conflict in human species, in our human civilization, is old. And what the Buddha was addressing, his teachings address, is suffering. And conflict is a form of suffering. And yet it is also, I think, an important thing to recognize is that conflict is also a place where growth can happen. When we, you know, essentially what we do when we open in our own experience, when we open to our own conflict, our internal conflict, we find places where there's struggle, where there's tension, it feels like there's some wars inside of us. And opening to that is how growth happens. Not by repressing it, not by pretending it's not there, not by kind of leaning in and kind of buying into some of those states of mind, but by being curious about them. That perspective I offered in the guided meditation of allowing, being present with. This is a way that there can be a transformation connected with conflict. This is really, in many ways, you know, the first noble truth the Buddha spoke of, the noble truth of suffering. He said of that truth, he said we should understand suffering. We should strive to not understand it intellectually, but understand it experientially. What is suffering? How does it come to be? What puts it together? Not intellectually, but to see the processes at work that do that. And hugely transformative. My own life has really transformed through looking at some of the hardest things. Looking at self-hatred, looking at depression, and seeing how the mind is participating in those. And then the seeing of that begins to help the mind to let go, to release it. And so the conflict in our culture, the conflict that's coming up in our society right now, you know, it's pointing to stresses, it's pointing to struggles, it's pointing to perhaps some deeper things that need to be seen and looked at and held and have some curiosity around. It takes courage, much as it takes courage to look at our own suffering. It takes a lot of courage to be willing to look at this conflict in our society and be curious about it. So in one teaching the Buddha gave, it's in the Majjhima Nikaya. I've been, over the last 2 or 3 weeks, I've been kind of diving into the suttas, looking for where the Buddha talked about conflict, where he talked about struggle and divisiveness and what he had to say about it. And one of the suttas where this comes up is actually called the Exposition on Non-Conflict. And in that teaching, he says that we should understand the state of conflict and understand the state without conflict. So conflict, you know, the word conflict, we think about what it means to us. You know, it often has a sense of contentiousness, kind of fighting against something, a resistance to something, perhaps. Sometimes a holding on to something. You know, not wanting something to change, you know, wanting it to stay a certain way. Maybe a sense of imbalance, stress. In the in this sutta, the state with conflict is described as a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. And it is the wrong way, the Buddha says. The state of conflict is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. The wrong way meaning the wrong way in terms of finding peace and freedom from suffering. That when we engage in, again, the Buddha really pointed to what are the conditions that will lead us away from suffering, and what are the conditions that will lead us towards suffering, we need to understand what leads us towards suffering and explore letting that go, explore finding another way. But sometimes what that means, at least in my experience, what that means is opening to the conflict, opening to what feels like pain, what feels like stress, what feels like suffering. And that is, again, back to the First Noble Truth. Understand the suffering. So I think what's interesting in that sentence of the state of conflict, he's pointing to conflict as being a state of mind. I think that's interesting. It's a state of mind that is conditioned, that comes into being based on certain conditions, and that can fall apart based on certain conditions. It's a state of mind. Conditioned, impermanent, and not self, not me, not who I am. This is a state of mind. So we could frame our meditation practice, kind of I was talking earlier about how we explore conflict internally. Now, our whole meditation process, our whole practice could be framed as exploring conflict, learning what it is, learning how it comes to be, and exploring the possibility of what non-conflict is. And so this understanding what is conflict and what is not conflict, some of that comes through our practice. When we experience states of mind that arise, we experience states in our mindfulness practice, certain states have a feeling of constriction, have a feeling of stress, have a feeling of tightness, of holding, pushing. And other states have a feeling of ease, of openness, of connection. And that experience, that difference, gives us a sense of what the difference is between conflict and non-conflict. And so we explore experience, how we explore experience, aware, curious about what the experience of conflict is. It's kind of interesting to, you know, hear the Buddha say something like, the state of conflict is the wrong way. And then to have the teaching be, just know that you're on the wrong, that you're going the wrong way. You know, just be aware of what that's like to be going the wrong way. It feels like, well, shouldn't I like change the direction? And sometimes that is useful. You know, if it feels like, you know, when we feel like we're heading the wrong way and we're not able to be aware of what it's like to be heading the wrong way, we're not able to be aware of the tension and this and the experience of that state itself, because it pulls us into the wrong way, it pulls us into the rabbit hole of it, then we have to do something. Then we have to take some action to consciously step towards something else, perhaps, to step towards maybe something neutral, or to step towards metta, holding ourselves with some compassion and kindness. And so there are times when taking some action, when it feels like we're going the wrong way, is helpful. But one of the main things to becoming, to having the wrong way become the right way, is to be aware, to have the mindfulness and the wisdom, knowing what's here. That makes that wrong way become the path towards freedom. It seems so counterintuitive that whatever is happening, just the smallest little shift, and sometimes it's not small. I mean, sometimes it doesn't feel small, but it is kind of just like almost a quarter turn of the mind to see it clearly and know that that's what's happening in the present moment. Then you're on the path. Then you are headed in the right way. So that practice of being curious about conflict, maybe we can bring that towards external conflict. What we've been talking about so far is the internal conflict, and what does it mean to be aware of that? Maybe we can turn towards external conflict in a similar way. Conflict with another is also a state constructed. Now that state, it's interesting perhaps to reflect on what conflict between people is. There is probably the individual conflict in each person. Maybe one person feels conflict and the other one doesn't. That's possible. But often what happens when there's conflict between people is that there is a back and forth process of conditioning going on. So it's, again, it's a conditioned state, this conflict that's arising between people. And maybe let's just think about two people right now. Let's not think about whole groups of people, but just two people. That there's a state, it's almost like the Buddha speaks about being aware internally, being aware externally, and then being aware both internally and externally. Being aware internally is being aware of our own processes, our own bodies, our own minds. Being aware externally, the understanding of that is that you're aware of the bodies and minds of others. A lot of that is inferential, you know, that you understand what's going on in somebody's mind more based on what you see and how they're responding. But there is a teaching around being aware of other people in this way. In the Satipatthana Sutta, it speaks about this, being aware externally. And then it talks about being aware internally and externally, which, you know, maybe, I don't know, you know, again, it's not really clear what it means, but I have had the experience with being with another person of there being a sense of a, we could say a we, that doesn't feel like me, and it maybe doesn't feel like the other person either. So there is that we can be aware of, maybe it's what we're aware of is how we are in the presence of this particular person? How do we influence each other? How do we shape each other? And that's conditioned. And we know this, you know, that when somebody says something out of anger, how it often will have anger arise in us. And then if we respond with anger, it feeds back and forth. So there's this dynamic process of conditioning going on. And so this is a part for us to understand. Conflict is conditioned, and it's not only conditioned just the cycle internally, but it's conditioned based on what I do, what I say, that affects the other person, what they do and what they say, along with all of the kind of history that we each have. You know, that history is brought to the event too. How we've been shaped, what beliefs we have, what views we have, all of that is brought to the interaction, and then we start influencing each other. So we can be curious about this, and so the conflict is a state that is conditioned. Again, it's a complex conditioning, just as, you know, my own self-hatred was a pretty complex conditioning. You know, to see into that, to look at that, and to begin to understand what was going on there. There was a lot of complex conditioning that was seen in that. And so it's not easy necessarily to understand the conditioning, especially somebody else's conditioning. You know, we can look at our own conditioning and remember our history and remember, like, oh, now I see why I believe that. You know, all of my family believed that too, you know, and so we can see our own conditioning as it has affected us. In relationship, that's usually harder. We don't know what somebody else's conditioning is. And so this is a place where I think we can bring curiosity and bring conversation, because that's how we, I think that the exploration of conflict, the being with conflict with another person, one of the main ways that we can do that is through speech, through dialogue, through trying to understand what the other person's conditions are, what those conditions are. So another piece, I'll go a little bit more into that in a moment, but the other piece I'll bring in is the piece around, I said earlier that when we look at conflict internally, you know, it is just a state. It is just a state of mind that arises based on conditions. It's not me. It's not permanent, and it's not who I am. It is a condition that arises. It is a state that arises based on conditions, and it will fall apart based on conditions. And so likewise, the conflict that arises between two people, it's not self. It's not me. It's not who I am. It's not who the other person is either. So that's another important thing. Sometimes we can put the conflict on the other person. If only you didn't believe that, then this conflict wouldn't be here. So that we can other in, and we talked about this. We talked about selfing and othering some weeks ago. So that this is an important point too, that when there's conflict between two people, it is not self and it is not other. It is created based on the conditions of these two people, these two conditionings coming together and influencing each other. And so how do we understand this? How do we explore it? There's a definition of dialogue that feels appropriate to me to bring in, because it does feel like we need to understand each other. So this again, so conflict is suffering. Understand suffering. How do we understand the suffering? Well, we can understand our own perspective, perhaps what we are reacting to, but how can we understand what somebody else is reacting to, except by trying to enter into a conversation with them. So can we be curious? Can we be aware with them and have that curiosity attempt to understand where they're coming from? So this definition of dialogue, this comes from the website All Sides. I don't know if you're familiar with this website. It's I was looking for some place that I could find unbiased news, you know, to help me kind of come out of my own bubble of information, you know, my own bubble of searching out what I already believe. You know, that's what we tend to do. We search out the information that we already believe. And I stumbled on this website, All Sides, which its premise is that there's nothing, there's no unbiased news, but that you can, you know, they will present the same story. They'll have the same story and they'll say, here's what the center media sources say about it. Here's what the right media sources say about it. And here's what the left media sources say about it. And so you can kind of read the variety of how people say things and see even, you know, a single word in a headline, how that skews the meaning, you know. And so you can get a sense of, oh, okay, you know, so you really can get a different take on the news. So I found this website to be very interesting. But the other thing, one of the things I really like about this website is they have a dictionary of words that kind of have different resonances for people on different parts of the political spectrum. And I think this is true of many words in a variety of ways, that we all have a meaning that we think we understand for that. And we assume people share that meaning. And so this dictionary kind of highlights particular words that may not have the same meaning for people. So that's also useful. You might begin to get a sense of where somebody's coming from. Just like I picked a few of these words. It's like, wow, that's interesting, you know, to see just through reading how people on different sides of the political spectrum might view the word. There was a little bit of understanding that came without even having a conversation with somebody. But they also had an entry for dialogue, and I clicked on that entry, and this is what describes dialogue. Dialogue has a unique aim. Rather than trying to convince or proselytize or resolve a conflict, the primary goal of dialogue is to understand more deeply other perspectives. Rather than being opponents who seek to expose the weakness in each other's arguments, dialogue participants engage in a conversation that starts with the assumption, as Thomas Schwant describes it, that the other has something to say to us and to contribute to our understanding. The initial task is to grasp the other's position in the strongest possible light. That's not what we typically do. We want to convince somebody of our perspective. And yet this dialogue is precisely what wise attention tries to do for our internal conflict, to understand the perspective of that conflict, to understand how it was put together. And through that understanding, something begins to shift. Wisdom begins to arise, wisdom begins to shift. And so can we trust, or can we explore this possibility of dialogue, of speech, to begin to understand a very different perspective and then see what happens out of that conversation? Now, this does, I think, perhaps take that both people are in the conversation in the same way. I have been in conversations with people where I felt like the other person was coming at it from a kind of a contentious perspective. And I explored, okay, well, I'm just going to try to, you know, ask what's your perspective, and to try to describe where my perspective is. And so, you know, just to try to have this dialogue rather than a convincing. And I was actually surprised that the other person shifted more towards dialogue from a place of contentiousness. When they were met with dialogue, they shifted more towards dialogue. And this, I think, is the power of mindfulness and wisdom and curiosity, you know, that kind of, well, let's see if we can understand each other. So, oh dear, I thought it was 8:20, but it's, I thought it was 8:21, but it's 8:27. So I've just got a couple minutes left. So the last piece that I'll bring in is, you know, again, speech is a big role in terms of conflict and the resolution of conflict. And the teachings encourage us to really take care with how we speak. So there's one teaching that says, what is well-spoken speech? And it offers five qualities. When speech possesses five qualities, it is well-spoken. It is blameless and irreproachable among the wise. What five? It is spoken at the proper time. What is said is true. It is spoken gently. What is said is beneficial. And it is spoken with a mind of loving kindness. So I think this is interesting. I just kind of noticed this today, the two different words. It is spoken and what is said. So it kind of distinguishes between how we speak and what we say. So what is said needs to be true and beneficial. How it is spoken, it needs to be spoken at a time, at the proper time, gently, and with a mind of loving kindness. It doesn't say that the what is said needs to be agreeable to the other person. It does encourage us to have a mind of kindness and gentleness in offering our speech. And I think these factors, these five factors, need to be applied both to ourselves and to others too. So, for instance, spoken at the proper time for ourselves and spoken at the proper time for somebody else. So at the proper time for ourselves, investigate ourselves. Is this a good time to talk about this? Am I balanced? Is my mind established in kindness and gentleness? What's my motivation for saying this? So, you know, to check in before speaking, you know, is this a good time for me to say this? And then also for the other person, you know, to be curious for them. Are they going to be able to receive it? Do we know that they're in a state where, you know, and maybe it could be a question, you know. I was asked to offer some feedback to somebody the other day, and I waited until they came to me to say, did you get a chance to think about that feedback? Would you be willing to share it with me? So I waited for them to come to me. And at that point, I felt confident that they would be able to hear it. So that kind of investigation is also important, I think, for each of these five factors. Spoken at the proper time, it's true, it's spoken gently, it's beneficial, and it's spoken with a mind of loving kindness. And if we think about those qualities, those are the qualities we also bring to our inner investigation. That gentleness, that mind of loving kindness, knowing when it's time to be observing. So, you know, when observing that self-hatred, there were some times that it was not the time to be observing it, that it was too sticky, it was pulling me into it. So no, not the time. I'm investigating, is what I'm telling myself true? So this, I think these five factors are kind of an interesting thing to reflect on, both internally with our own practice and externally. So, yeah, it's time to stop.